Welcome to First Person Scholar. This is Editor-in-Chief Steve Wilcox with our first feature interview, Jesper Juul. Jesper Juul is the author of three books on video games, starting with Half Real back in 2005, followed by A Casual Revolution in 2010, and most recently The Art of Failure in 2013. He's currently a visiting assistant professor at the New York University Game Center, and he joins me now to talk about all of the above. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Now, before I get into things, I'd just like to outline the format. Given that First Person Scholar is directed at game scholars, many people in our audience are going to be familiar with your work. So I'm going to take a different approach from the standard interview, because in a way it's like you and I have already talked. I've read your writing, I've listened to your recent interviews, and so what I'd like to do is ask questions about the answers you've already given. So let's start off with your most recent work. In The Art of Failure, as well as in Half Real and A Casual Revolution, I'm often wondering, do games have to be fun to be successful?
So successful in a commercial sense?
Or maybe even in a critical sense?
Well, so it's an interesting question. So the first problem is obviously the word fun. I'd like to start by relating an anecdote that I heard Marc LeBlanc make. So Marc LeBlanc co-wrote this paper called MDA, the Mechanics, Dynamics, Aesthetics model. And he talked about how it was a response to the fact that in early kind of game design discussion, he'd experienced that people would assume that anything you said about video games should either be universal, and if it wasn't universal, it would be false. So there was a tendency towards this idea of the kind of the one perfect game. And I think you could say the problem with the word fun was always that, right? So it sounds like there is this one thing that is the thing, that is the experience you're supposed to have from a good game, and if you're not having that experience, then it's not working. And so that's obviously false. But I do think we tend to use fun as this kind of umbrella term for all kinds of experiences, some of which, in a way, might look like what we traditionally consider fun, so you might be, say, like smiling, and some of which actually don't look like it at all, so which may look much more like sort of pain or sort of feeling uncomfortable or really being unhappy. So I definitely think this is not a... Even if you're just thinking of, say, commercial success, I don't think kind of fun in this kind of positive, happy sense is a necessity.
Right.
But I think the interesting thing is that we probably associate perhaps like the absence of fun with kind of seriousness, right? You could say that these kind of intuitive reasons for doing that. So I do think that definitely is a kind of feeling that if you're supposed to do a kind of serious game, not in the kind of educational sense, but one that deals with like important themes, then that has to be non-fun in some way, right? And you can also see it similarly in our relation to stories. We do tend to assume that a kind of good story is one that has a somewhat unhappy ending, and then if it's a happy ending, somehow it's kind of shallow. So I do think we have these kind of intuitive ideas of sort of importance being kind of seriousness and earnestness and sort of frivolity being sort of happiness and so on. And I do think that's obviously, one of that is obviously wrong, but it's kind of probably the way we intuitively approach it.
That's a great lead into the second question I had, which is in The Art of Failure, you remark that failure in games tells us that we are flawed and deficient. And as such, video games are the art of failure, the singular art form that sets us up for failure and allows us to experience and experiment with failure. And that really reminded me of Paolo Pedersini's Flash game, you know, Every Day the Same Dream.
Yeah.
Have you played that?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, so for those that haven't, you play a character that repeatedly goes through a rather mundane daily routine. You know, you wake up, you dress, you commute to work, you sit at a cubicle, and then you repeat. But in a way, the fun and interesting aspects don't start until you fail the game by choosing not to conform to that routine. And I just wondered how a game like that looks through the lens of the art of failure.
Well, so obviously it's one that kind of plays with our expectations for failure. So another less serious example is in Knit Stories. There's this game called, this level called Don't Eat the Mushroom, where if you don't eat the mushroom, basically nothing happens. You complete the game and everything interesting happens if you do eat the mushroom, which you're not supposed to. So I do think there's like a few different aspects to it. One is that there might be like the overt signaling from the game that this is what you're supposed to do and this is the goal that you can fail against. And then, say, every day the same dream. Obviously, in a way, that's kind of a parody of traditional game design and the kind of, you would say, the traditionalness of the whole kind of setting and graphical style goes hand in hand with that. And the kind of reveal is one that kind of is supposed to make you question both games and really like the kind of setting, the kind of dreary drab life. But I do think that actually might be a slightly different question than the question of what kind of feels really, what might feel bad or unpleasant for you as a player, because I think that's fundamentally mostly defined by what you are personally trying to achieve, right? So say, even though you can say, like, every day the same dream appears to be about, like, conforming to this, and then obviously in a way, kind of the kind of intended success criteria of the game is really to be doing what normally at first seems like failing, but that is actually turns out to be actually in a success in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
But then, of course, as a player, then if you knew that, then you actually, in a way, like, failed to fail, you would actually still be failing, right? Because you'd be failing against whatever you're personally trying to achieve. And so that goes for any kind of counterplaying that you might do in any game, that I think the most important thing is always the kind of goal that you've actually been setting for yourself, rather than the official goal. And then, of course, like, perhaps most of the time, I do think we are trying to follow the official goal, but when we're not, it's the important thing is certainly like what we're personally trying to achieve.
Yeah, it's interesting in that game that one of the things that you can achieve is to throw yourself off the building that you work at as a sort of act of rebellion against it. So that's embracing that sense of failure, but you're also succeeding because you're not conforming in a certain respect. So my next question is kind of a long-winded question, but it's a connection I made when I was reading The Art of Failure. So in the book, you talk about mood management theory, where we choose entertainment in part because we want to control our moods. So we watch a thriller because we're bored, or we watch a comedy because we want to laugh. And you say the same holds true for games. But while reading that section, I couldn't help but think of the mood organ in Philip K. Dick's Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep?
Oh, it's been a while.
So the machine, this is something that can dictate your disposition at the touch of a button. And so in the book, we hear about the option called 888, and that's the desire to watch TV no matter what is on. And in some registers, that's the ideal structure of a game, the desire to play no matter the content. So what I'm getting at is that mood management theory applied to gaming seems to suggest that the Wii can function kind of like that mood organ. But in Do Androids Dream, the mood organ is a means of controlling your feelings to make you kind of essentially complacent. So my question is mood management theory liberating or constraining when it comes to games? Or sort of put differently, is it something that we should value, or is it something that we should be suspicious of?
Well, that's an interesting question. I see what you mean, that in a way that it can be kind of perceived or at least sort of understood as something that has a kind of dishonesty about it or kind of too much kind of control or management. Well, I mean, so it's a particular theory that seems to hold true at least part of the time for like our media or those kind of media choices that we do make these choices to influence our future moods. And then, of course, there is also, even in like a comedy, there might be some kind of unpredictability about it. And I'm just saying that in a way that games, it's even stronger in a way that there is this kind of game that you perform. If you kind of, you want to play a game in order to succeed, in order to become heavy. And then there is a kind of gamble that's kind of pretty concrete in games in terms of you might lose, right? You want to, you might feel stuck in your whatever you're trying to do, and then you think that if I just play a StarCraft 2 match online and then I'll win against someone, I'll feel like much better and invigorated in my work life, and then it may not actually pan out that way. So you may be in a way like worse off than you were before. But in the end, it is interesting. So I mean, it's possible to. It's a kind of very big human question. Is it bad of us? Is it wrong of us to try to kind of influence our future moods in this kind of fairly instrumental way, or is it something kind of liberating in this kind of freedom to make your own choices regarding that? I guess it's somewhat out of the scope of the book. I think it's certainly something that humans do, and it. It also cuts across like fine art or kind of popular art or theories. You might even read a theoretical paper in order to feel in a particular way, say smart, for example.
Right.
And it's just, I think it's more like a fact. It's something we do all the time. It's kind of hard to imagine us not doing that, not having that kind of planning ahead.
I think what I'm trying to angle at is I'm personally becoming more and more suspicious of games that it's like they're fine tuning a formula to make you compelled to feel that you need to play and you need to participate, and by tying the mood in with that formula, you look at games like Farmville or Angry Birds. It's almost like they're perfecting that mood organ that can make you feel that sense of joy, but there's no underlying challenge there that's asking you to be more critical. And I think that at the Game Developers Conference a couple of weeks ago, Jay McGonigal touched on this when she said that one of the biggest barriers facing games right now is still that sense of escapism that we attach to games, and that we look towards them as a means of escape. And I'm wondering how mood management theory in relation to games and escapism, how those are interrelated within your work.
Yeah, so I guess like for the first part of it, I'm kind of skeptical of these kind of ideas that there are certain games that in a way touch or like just like manipulate our emotions and then or are kind of brain hacks, and that there will be other games that are not. I'm not sure how you'd actually make that distinction. I mean, so obviously all games in some way cater to psychological needs in some way, or work in relation to how we work psychologically, and so no games are really kind of out there. And as for escapism, again, it's also one of those. I think it's also such a broad thing that it's almost impossible to actually to make such a clear call, right? You would say that, so. Actually, one thing about Jane McGonigal, obviously, is that she works from this kind of positive psychology tradition, which is very much about managing the mood, using various kind of devices and structures. So I think she'd be kind of on board with that. I'm not sure. I think the kind of escapism question is in a way, it's almost like the general question of like all kinds of art and culture. Like, why do we do it, even though it doesn't seem to be strictly necessary for our immediate needs? And at the same time, those are exactly the things that we kind of tend to value, right? That in a way that they seem valuable because they're not obviously valuable. They seem valuable because it's something we can choose to do and not to do. So when we say like decorate our homes with art or we play music, it also in a way makes us feel as feel important or feel that our life has meaning beyond simply like kind of stuffing our faces with calories, right? So I think that escapism in a way is really kind of a general criticism you might level at kind of culture in general. So I think it's perhaps too broad a stroke.
Okay, fair enough. I'm interested in, because I find when I'm reading your work, it seems that playing games is inherently valuable in and of itself. So, you know, following your argument in Casual Revolution, it seems like learning to play any game is sort of intrinsically good. And I definitely sympathize with that position, because games have often suffered from the stigma that it's not a real element in our culture, and that it's often dismissed. But the cynic in me looks at the number of hours that we've logged into Farmville and Angry Birds, and I'm wondering if there's a distinction to be made between, say, teaching someone to read and teaching someone the value of challenging themselves through what they choose to read.
Yeah. I mean, so games are on the meta category, right? So it is, when I say it's about learning, it's obviously, sorry, when I say it's about failure, it obviously also implies that it's about learning, as many people, such as Jim Polgiis, has argued. I think it's kind of hard to make the entirely general case. So you see, I'm always like kind of, it's one of those things, right? So I do think, I sort of personally have an experience of games being kind of deeply meaningful, that in a way, it's almost always interesting to learn to play a new game and to improve. There's always something that's kind of fundamentally satisfying about that. On the other hand, I'm also skeptical about, in a way, like making that in a kind of too broad or too kind of self-assured argument. Right? That in a way, it's kind of very easy to make this claim that obviously games are good for us. Games lead to kind of profound insights and profound self-insights. And it prepares to do well at work and in school and so on. But in a way, I think that the problem is it's very easy to make this argument. And I do think, in a way, it's also kind of too easy. And then, in a way, it wouldn't even if you actually did a study and then like proved beyond all reasonable doubt that clearly, if you just like make the kids play Halo or like every day the same dream, then this improves their reading scores by 3% averaged over 5 years. Right, in a way that even that actually wouldn't be very enjoyable, right? Because then games would certainly lose some of that like for their own sake, like game for game's sake, element that they have already. So I'm worried. I'm in a way that it's kind of tempting to make these kind of arguments. How good games are for you, but I'm kind of skeptical. I'm very, very wary of doing that.
Okay. I guess as a follow-up to that, should we be more critical of games that sort of just tap into the desire to play, but that don't challenge us to question that desire?
Yeah, it's a good question. So certainly there's some kind of game that does it in a kind of interesting way. So I guess even though by now it's like almost an old controversial example, I do think like Bioshock, the first one does have something interesting about the kind of following orders element of games. I guess I always waver between being a snob and being kind of inclusive on these terms. So I do like this idea that there's like a large variety of interesting experiences to be had, and in a way I don't want to be the kind of judge of what's good and bad, but then in other situations I do want to be a snob, right? And so for example, I'm not sure it's Farmville as much as it's role-playing games, if I want to be critical of a particular game genre, so like the whole idea of the resources gathering and the skills amassing in the character or characters that you're controlling, in a way, it is a little weird, right? Because it's not you, it's the character, so it's a kind of external thing, and in a way, like, it feels like you're improving, but it might just be the character. And so I think that that's probably the argument that I'm most sympathetic to. And you say, even Angry Birds is actually, in this case, it's much better than World of Warcraft as a game, because it's more about fundamentally about learning. On the other hand, I do think I do enjoy a game like Mass Effect. There are certain kind of things you can get out of that, because it's also because in a way it's more of a kind of troll experience, right? Even though it seems you're doing something very unique, leveling up your character, it's also something that is sort of guaranteed over time. So it's a particular way of structuring your experience, the whole leveling up. And so I'm just saying that, again, similarly, you, I think I can. It's always complicated. It's kind of relationship between what you like and what you can make an argument for, right? And I think, as I also discussed in the book, that there is a kind of certain temptation to have certain things that you personally like, and then construct some kind of theoretical argument for why that's the right thing and why everybody else is wrong. I think one should always be a little worried about doing that, but then I think the good news is that there usually tends to be some kind of hole in the argument that, in my experience, you always, like, regardless of what kind of argument you're trying to construct, you always end up spending some time playing something that doesn't fit the argument.
That's a great point.
So in a way, that's also what part of what's interesting about theorizing about games, is there is a kind of gap in a way between what you kind of intuitively seem to be picking up and then the kind of arguments you make around it. And there's always some kind of hole or gap between those two that kind of forces you to kind of keep thinking.
Yeah, that's great, because I actually have a question here that kind of gets right at that. Yeah, I find that there's a tendency in game scholarship to try to essentialize some aspect of video games. So for a number of years, scholars have been looking for, like, the quintessential element that makes a game a game. And so, you know, is it the rules? Is it the narrative? Is it the player? And I found that, you know, the answer really depends on the sample of games being drawn from, to the point that it's difficult to separate a theory of games from the games played to develop that theory. So, given that the sometimes radical differences between the genres, can the term game itself really apply to all titles and still be a useful concept?
Yeah, so let's see. I think the term sort of like essentialism, I think, in a way, it's a kind of sound critical move, but it's also something that I think sometimes prevents us from some kind of asking certain questions. So, for example, like one question I was interested in was the question, like, do the things that we call games have anything in common? And I do think the answer is, by and large, yes. But I think you can only actually ask that question if you're not afraid of getting a yes answer. Right? And so the idea of something like essentialism, in a way, it kind of says, oh no, you should always answer no. It's very important. And so worry about that being a kind of way of not answering certain questions that are actually pretty interesting. Yeah, but of course, true, like, games are also a pretty wide field. I do think that there's a reason why we tend to use something like the word game. And I do think that they have their certain kind of rule structures and kind of goal-directedness that they have in common. And then a certain sense of what I call the negotiable consequences, but it's also somewhat tied to ideas of, say, like things being voluntary and things being, in a way, presented or understood as being not essential, in a way, or not important.
Well, I think
as direct as say, like, eating or going to work is, and that is part of the experience. And then you just say that there are a lot of different experiences, and there are lots of different games that, in a way, build on this in different kinds of ways. And then you have more recent things like not games, which it's very clear that people are very conflicted about it, even people who defend them as games, because like a game like Proteus is also very clearly an attempt at making something that is different from the things we regularly call games. And I know that the designers, for some reason, then have been felt very disturbing to hear people saying it's not a game, even though it's very clearly designed to be at least a not a game, and even though it kind of still wins lots of prizes in game festivals. So I guess I think it's important to still be able to talk about whether things are something in common, or say, like, whether there's anything in particular we expect when something's labeled a game, or whether we design a game. And I think the answer to that is clearly yes. And of course, then at the same time, it's also something that evolves over time. So when SimCity came out, there was a big sense that it wasn't a game. And today, these days, I think people in general don't have a lot of issues with naming in their games. So clearly, the kind of the term game, especially video game, has kind of become broader during the last 20 years.
Yeah. I think, I guess, embedded in that question, though, is also sort of when we look to find the essential aspect of a game, it's really harkens back to the ludology versus narratology, and what's the real substructure that other things are built around, and that really brings me to your talk in Half Real, because you put forward the notion that the rules are more real than the narrative, and I just wonder what does it mean to say that something is only half real.
All right, so I'm using this, and this is in a particular, in a way, technical sense. Right, so real, it doesn't mean whether things kind of exist, or whether they mean something to us or not, or whether they kind of have a cultural significance or not. Or what it refers to is or what it means, what it concerns is the question of reference world. Right, so if you have a game rule, in a way, it's something that structures how we relate it in this world, right? But a narrative is something, a fictional narrative is something that refers to a fictional world that we imagine. And they're also just two different, you could say that a game rule and a game story has two different reference worlds. So one is like the actual physical world, and the other reference world is this kind of imagined world in which the game takes place. So that's what it means to say that game rules are real in that sense. So I do think a lot of people sort of confuse it as to be or read it as to saying like more important or the only real or the only important thing. So that's not what it means.
Okay, but if you're a modder, or you're a cheater or hacker, the rules can be just as much a fiction as the narrative, in a certain respect. Is that fair?
Well, I would say fiction, but it's more like it's a particular kind of fact that you can get around, right?
Okay.
And then you can make your own. So rules may also still be kind of malleable, or there might be an official set of rules you might be playing by different rules and official rule set, but those rules are still in a way just like both the official rules and your kind of hacked rules are still the kind of world that they concern is still kind of this world. Like what can you do? What are you supposed to do? What will actually happen if the computer ever press this button?
Okay, so it's kind
so
of
you, so by fiction you're saying you're using fiction in the sense that it's not say like necessary, or it's not like an internal kind of fact, but this is like a slightly different way of using fiction than I'm using it, because the way I use fiction really refers to that you have to imaginary play or imagining a particular world.
Right. I guess I'm trying to get at that fiction in the sense that it's a variable that we keep constant by believing in it or playing along with it, which the rules of a game system can be just as flexible in that respect as the narrative. I'm just wondering what...
Sure. It's fiction in a slightly different sense than I'm
okay. Fair enough. So what's the value then in using that term real and saying that it's more real? Can you just clarify what that brings to the discussion that you're putting forward here?
Oh, sure. So I think one of the things it ties into is this question of what we're actually doing when we play games. And games do have this weird tendency for us to talk about the fictional content as if it was real. So like, yeah, I ran someone over in my car, right? So you talk about it as if it happened, even though it didn't happen. And so fiction, in a way, is just a way of kind of explaining what that is, right? That it's not that there is a world inside a game, but it's more that the game makes you think of a particular world in which this happened. And then you can talk about how this relates to the rule system. And then, of course, fiction is also meant as an alternative term to narrative. So it was a way of kind of dodging the kind of inherent difficulties in the kind of story or narrative game debate, because narrative has a lot of different meanings, one of them being say, like a fictional world, and one of them being like a string, a fixed sequence of events. And that created a lot of kind of confusion when people talked about games and narratives, because, oh my god, how can you have a game that's narrative? Because a game has to be interactive, and a narrative has to be non-interactive, and so on. And then fiction, in the sense I'm using it from Thomas Powell and others, is a much broader concept, which also relates to like playground, play, and so on, and all kinds of imagining. So it's also, I think it also ties video games more clearly into like imaginary play. I know on your side you had an article on Kendall Walton recently. So mm-hmm. I was actually using him for my original PhD thesis to discuss fiction, but I actually ended removing him for the book.
Yeah.
So he used to be there.
Okay. Interesting. So in your latest book, you mentioned three elements in games that each represent a political ideal, skill, chance, and labor. And with skill, you draw the parallel with a meritocracy. And I think that's a great point, especially in respect to the casual revolution. So I wondered if you could expand on that connection between skill and meritocracy, but in the context of casual games.
Oh, interesting, yeah. Yeah, it's also like the kind of relation is one I partially borrow from, or the kind of name, the political labels is one I partially borrow from the study of Norwegian school children that's discussed in the book. So I do think, as I say in the book, there really are like a number of different ideas of what fairness is, both in games and politically, and people will always tend to call their particular brand of it fairness, I think. So the idea of casual games, I think people have been criticizing it a lot because this idea of accessibility can, at least at a distance, seem like everybody can win, everybody can get ahead, and something like that. I do discuss in a way it's actually much more complicated than that. So even kind of very classic, say, Magic Tower games like Bejeweled may actually get really, really challenging, pretty soon, actually. So it's not really the case that the games we call casual necessarily particularly easy. So they may actually be very heavily skill based. And conversely, like role playing games, are often quite easy in the sense that they just reward you for your time investment. So I think it's more that in a way that things like casual games and Facebook games have often been kind of divided or criticized because people assume that they don't require any skill, and that is bad. Of course, it's actually much more complicated than that. Like a lot of them do require a lot of skill, and a lot of say more traditional games don't require any skill. But of course, it's also a bit of a question of what the kind of experience you're desiring is, right? So if you think from a purely kind of enjoyment perspective, there is something to accept for games where you're almost guaranteed to get anywhere by putting in some time. Of course, then there's something kind of enjoyable about that. But it's just a particular kind of fairness. I won't say that any one of these is necessarily the better one. But again, I do in a way very intuitively think there's something wrong with just rewarding for time investment. But at the same time, it also can be a particular kind of experience, such as especially I think a story-driven RPG, because it's something that in a way like propels you through the continent in a kind of particular way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there's an interesting point there too, in terms of those games where you essentially pay not to play. You can spend X amount of dollars and get this far ahead. And in the context of a meritocracy, the idea that you can pay to not develop those skills is kind of it's a great commentary, especially on certain political and economic systems as well. So
but then of course, I mean, so it's not that time is money, right? But I mean, some situations there might be a kind of equivalence between them, and certainly I think. So I tend to joke that there should be like an executive version of certain like long single player games. So where you might, I do think most single player games have long periods of boredom, so it's like in the middle sometimes, because that's the kind of the kind of boxed model where you pay for a game, it really doesn't encourage developers to put much time in like polishing the middle. It encourages them to put time in the beginning and then possibly the ending, if there's something for the journalist to write about. And so in a way, why not have a version where you pay twice as much to play hell, to skip the boring little section? And in a way, that's what free to play is sometimes, except because it's not that kind of structure particularly, but in a way, why not? Right?
Yeah, absolutely. I just have another set of questions, just kind of more on education and your methodology. As an educator, how do you find teaching game studies? And are there any things that have surprised you in your time teaching game studies to your students?
Well, I mean, so you know, it's something I've been teaching for a while, so more than 10 years at least. So I do think that perhaps the important thing often is to make it clear for students why a particular discussion was important at the time. And so in a way it's about, so I think a lot of it is the setup, right? So explaining why a particular discussion occurred and what the kind of games that came out were at the time. So let's just take the question of storytelling. I think the thing that's changed, and I think it's if you were ask me what surprised me, I think it is in a way how quickly culture moves on from something like the situation that led to the whole kind of narrative debate. Because this was at a time, so I usually have students reading Janet Murray, and then I have to talk about like the whole thing about CD-ROMs and full motion video and how this was the hot thing in the 1990s. Then talk about like the dream of virtual reality and how this was kind of really at the forefront of what people were thinking, and how this, in a way, it often was kind of conflated with the internet, which somehow sometimes was described as being 3D, whatever that was supposed to mean, and how, in a way, to say like the title of like Hamlet on the Holodeck, the future of narrative in cyberspace, in a way, was a kind of interesting juxtaposition. It's like, oh my god, with computers and technology for these various kind of cultural things. It's so amazing. And in a way that you would say that the surprise in a way has been how quick you can see that every year that just becomes more and more distant. And then I think teaching is often about explaining why a particular discussion played out at a particular moment in time and why that was so important or why that felt so important. So I think that's pretty important when you teach game studies.
You seem to favor, it's more on the methodology side of things, you seem to favor a quantitative empirical approach.
I do.
So what role should empirical analyses have in game studies, and you know, what can they add, but also what are their limits as well?
So the limits of empirical approaches?
Yeah. Within the context of game studies, how much explanatory work can they do for us?
Well, realistically, I come from a kind of very traditional humanities background. So every time I do something with sort of numbers or anything empirical, I can imagine sort of like my old professors sort of nodding or shaking their heads in disapproval, because that's not the kind of thing that they'd want. I just think that that's the different kind of questions that ask in a way like require a different kind of ways of answering them. So in our field, most of the stuff or the things I discussed in a way are more kind of are quite open to sort of straight up analysis in a way. Whereas in the casual revolution, many of the things that go on are much more about how do questions of say like attitudes to different player groups, for example, and also like the attitudes of the players themselves to different types of games. So and this is just not something you can answer analytically. So it's just a question that actually, in a way, just has to have some kind of empirical data in it. And then in the new book, I refer to some of these sort of studies I did on different kinds of failure, which was this kind of quantitative studies where you can say that did a few different kinds of studies, and in a way I find them often quite frustrating, right? Because then once you have it's a classical problem, like once you have the numbers, like what does the lecture show you? And so I think it depends a lot on the particular question, right? So, but often I think you end up with the graph and the bars and the error bars and the calculation some statistical significance, but then you often find out that in a way there was a different question that actually comes before this one, so which you didn't find that answer. In a way you just reveal a different question. So I think it really depends. And quantitative methods, I think, can be quite frustrating because of that, because they only show like a correlation between things, but don't necessarily reveal anything about how things work.
Right. What are your thoughts on current game scholarship? You know, are we missing anything right now, and where should we go from here?
Good question. I do think there is. Of course, there is always a tendency to deal with things that follow a particular model, right? So the reason why, say, Shadow of the Colossus was so popular was that in a way it catered to a particular kind of textual analysis. Like the reason why World of Warcraft was so popular in Academia too was that it also catered well to a particular kind of more the kind of social science approach. And so I think and all of that is good. I do think the challenge is always perhaps trying to talk about important games that don't necessarily fit any particular model well. And so I do think there's a kind of gap, right? So I don't think people aren't writing a whole lot on, let's say, free to play, for example. There's very little has been written on free to play, but it's really a kind of huge, it's a really huge thing that's happening right now, for example. I mean, some stuff has been written on independent games, but I think nothing in proportion to how kind of important that and changing distribution models are. But so I think that really is the kind of challenge to pay attention to what's happening or what's haven't been said, and just find games that are important in different ways, but when they're finding out how you talk about something, even when it doesn't fit obviously with any particular method.
Yeah.
So you can say the problem, so perhaps put it another way, the problem is always like method lines, right? That everything, in a way, you're always seeing things from the method that you're used to using.
Right, and I think that gets back to our earlier talk about how the theory of games you end up developing is inseparable from the games you use to develop that theory, and it's very,
yes.
It's very much about, to a degree, it's confirmation bias. You're looking for the things that validate your theory, and that's kind of what the publication we're working on now at First Person Scholars, to try to focus, and I'm sure you can sympathize with this as a ludologist, to focus on play and gameplay first, and then extend out to other areas if those connections are there. I think,
sure.
You know, personally, it seems that there is that tendency to come with your own method and then look for the evidence that supports it.
Yeah. So another way to put it is that you only get so much luck, right? So if you think that for every paper you write in, you're lucky in that you've been taught the right method, then probably something's probably wrong.
Fair enough. That's a good point. One last question to wrap this up. I'm keenly interested in asking this of game scholars, developers, anybody. It's a really simple question. You know, what can games do? What's their potential? What's the upper limit on the role games can play in our lives?
Well, games could do a lot of things. I think it's kind of it's very hard to actually put the boundaries around these things. So obviously, in the latest book, I discuss games as a kind of a laboratory for dealing with your own personal relations to failure and overcoming failure. And I do think that hopefully writing the book has actually made me both a better player and a better worker, if you will. So I do think that games are a good way of judging how you're dealing with the kind of setbacks and of a situation, and perhaps trying to figure out if there might be certain approaches that you tend to use in games, but that you could actually use elsewhere. So I do think there is a kind of potential for a kind of useful experimentation. If you think in the kind of broader sense, so in a way, games have already won, right? So that wasn't the case 10 years ago, but now more than 50% of the population actually plays digital games. And this is just like mostly after cell phones came around to games. So in a way there isn't any particular reason why not everybody would play digital games. Like eventually, so would say it's also clear in a way that things like tablets actually even becoming distribution channels for what seems to be board games, but just in a way like presented in video game form. So in a way, in that kind of breadth, it does seem that games, digital games in a way, like have already won.
Is that a good thing, though?
I think it's good.
Because in a way, that also means that there's a much larger market to be tapped into from a marketing and business perspective as well.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, so, but in a way, it's also, but we'd say, another way to put it would be just be that it's not even video games that have won, but it's just that games that continue to win, right? Because it's not, in a way, the computer or the tablet is just another game platform that just happened to come up after, so like cards, board games or rocks. So it's not that, in a way, it's not that different, right? It just in a way seemed that for a time, like, that there was something about computers that kind of meant only a certain portion of the population would be playing games with them. And that kind of, well, alright, that wasn't the case. In terms of content, in a way, it does seem to be playing out. I guess it's in a way you could hope, I think. So I guess I tend to be, I don't know, I guess I'm a bit of a, I think, I'm not sure I'm an optimist. I think I'm a realist in the sense that I understand that things take time. And I do think that, so like both academically, it's been going, I think, fairly well in terms of, say, getting academic programs and like publications and so on, getting that kind of going. So that's been positive. And then, but I think that the real change, interesting change the last 10 years has been like the rise of, let's just call them independent games, right? Or experimental games at least. That I do think that 10 years ago most people wouldn't be able to recognize something like an independent game, it just looked like a bad game.
Yep.
And during that period of time, it's just in a way that even like big publishers like Sony are suddenly like trying to kind of play it up, oh, we have independent games too. That in a way that there's a kind of much broader appreciation of the fact that you can have games that come in different shapes and sizes and different aesthetics and try to kind of express new things. And so that also is not only like a technological distribution thing, it's also in a way like a kind of sophistication of the audience question, right? That the people, a lot of players really understand that there is such a thing as this often perhaps short form or kind of different aesthetics or different thematic kind of game, and then they're kind of starting to have a way of talking about that or understanding that. And in a way, you'd say that the kind of sophistication, if you assume that's a good thing, I assume that's a good thing, of games also in a way comes from that, right? This idea that there's an audience which could make these kind of more interesting or more deep or more kind of more meaningful kind of experiences that also perhaps like work or answer previous games or perhaps like toy with like expectations for what a game should be. So in a way, so we say that in a way that's in a way where games are going, right? It's not really a technological thing necessarily. It's not even necessarily perhaps game design per se, but just in a way, just that there is a kind of discourse or kind of understanding that you can do strange things in games that may mean new things, may create new kinds of experiences. So in a way, that's, I wouldn't even say the rise of the critical discourse, but just in a way that there's an appreciation, more of an appreciation of the experiments and of things, games that try to say or do things. And I do think that's definitely the good news, that's hopefully where games are going.
Yeah, I guess that sort of connects back to our earlier question about, you know, essentially the literacy to play games is there, and now I think that means that we should be more critical of games that don't necessarily push that literacy into new areas, and kind of getting at games that are sort of Call of Duty line of games that seem part of a series where they found their formula and they're happy with just seeing how that plays out. But I find historically we haven't been that, game scholars haven't been that critical of that iterative approach as games in a series. And I find a lot of articles and essays and books even that I don't find are critical enough of how that's sort of playing out, that they're just in a sense almost pandering to the audiences in a way. And I wonder if that's something that you see as well, or if that's another issue.
Yeah, and again, so I think this goes back to this kind of being a snob versus being inclusive question.
Yep.
So I mean, I've been known to play games like Battlefield personally. So but again, I can also explain why I think that they're bad games.
Right.
And so I'm a bit in a way torn on this one. So I do think in a way they're not interesting games, right? And there is something sad about these $100 million titles that do exactly what every other game kind of used to do, right? So for GDC, so Chris Hecker had this wonderful rant, which is, I don't know if you saw the video. It was just these videos of people, say like a PlayStation 4 conference or press conference, explaining all the amazing things they would do with this platform, and then it was just like these guys running around shooting, and it's got a semi-sci-fi setting, and it's like, what? I mean, this, I've seen this a million times before, like what? And then this kind of weird juxtaposition of this, all these kind of promises, and you're just like, it was impossible to see anything that had changed at all. And so I think that's obviously in a way kind of pretty, that's kind of depressing. I think it's mostly depressing in a $100 million game. But it kind of also depends on what you think games should be, and I think there is a kind of range, right? Should every game entirely try to reinvent games, or is it okay to have something that's more like akin to like a crossword puzzle, which doesn't kind of try to reinvent crossword puzzles, but say like the next installment of Call of Duty or Battlefield is just your Sunday paper with crossword puzzles. And so that is what it is, and I do think there's some, it's not illegitimate to do that, but it's also something that's kind of okay about that. It's not terribly interesting. I think it's a bit uninteresting when, it's kind of sad when the game costs $100 million and there's this kind of incredible claims for how new it is, and it is, it's a Sunday crossword, right?
Yeah, I think that's what I'm getting at, is that the game reviewers and to a degree the scholars, I don't feel that they exert enough pressure as they should on games that are doing that. And I know that we don't have much of an influence, but I feel that that's the starting point, is to be a little more critical now that we have this sort of literacy, you know, following the casual revolution. People are familiar with how to play games. Now let's keep pushing the envelope. And I think that speaks to that as well.
Yeah, I mean, I do think these days there is a lot of kind of public criticism, or say like the big military shooters. So again, what does it actually matter as long as the sales do change? Probably not all that much. And then even I do think you even see that in some of the big shooters, they're trying to, in a way, like put interesting moral quandaries inside them and so on. It's not really something that I think is kind of quite as successful as they were hoping to. But yeah, I do think that we don't tend, actually, academics write very little about military shooters, in the same way that we always never write about, say, like sports games. There's just like a little bit of writing coming out recently about sports games. Mm-hmm. So in a way, I do think, again, it's also the kind of comfort zone aspect, where we tend to stick with what we know how to write about, and then all the games we personally like, and it's kind of hard to talk about kind of other games because we are invading it a bit. But in a way, I think, yeah, so it's true. In a way, you would hope that there might be more kind of game criticism, perhaps types of game studies that are more open about calling out the kind of bullshit of these kind of very self-similar games that claim to be new, even when they're not.
Great. All right. Thanks so much for taking the time to speak with us. Much appreciated.
Okay, sure.
And hopefully, if you get a chance to come up to Waterloo at some point, we'd love to hear you speak. That'd be a real treat for us.
That would be great.
Excellent.
No, that was a good discussion.
Great. Yeah, thanks so much for taking the time. Really appreciate it.
Thanks.
All right, take care.
Take care.